You're supposed to do that when it's over. Okay. Tomorrow is going to be a whole talk about NoSQL, but before we get there, I hope that to give you just a very high-level view what NoSQL is, why do we even need it, and what sort of NoSQL options are there out there. I'm not going to focus about specific products. I'm going to focus about categories of products. And blah, 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 doesn't care about that. Okay, doesn't care about that. This is the target. Okay, you're supposed to head out with a headache. Okay. So for a very long time, we had a very simple solution every time that you wanted to store data. You want to store data, you had two options. A text file, if you were, you know, some toy application, or you could be a part of the big boys and use a relational database. Now, that has been the case for the last 20 plus years, where 99.9999 of the application use some form of a relational database. Until we found that there is this thing called the web, and there's all those users. And at that point, we run into a very a big problem with relational database. Relational database assume that you have access to the entire data set in order to perform operations. That is an interesting part of what a relational database is. Imagine a distributed relational database that is composed of, well, I don't know, 500 machines. And I want to update the user state, the user record. And the user record may have phone keys. In order to verify that the phone key is valid, the relational database would have to access 500 machines. Or try to imagine that I want to say, okay, give me the latest 500 registered users, sort them by name. In order to do that, again, the relational database will have to access 500 machines. The model itself does not work. The model does not work because of the assumption that they have access to the entire data set. And in order to solve that, we have the notion of sharding. Sharding basically means, okay, let's take a database, chop it up into little pieces, and put all the users that start with A in this server. All the users starting with B in that server. Now, if I want to access the users, I know, okay, I want to access the user record for AMD. It's sitting in this server, I can just grab it and use it. So, in this manner, I haven't avoided a problem. I haven't solved the problem, I just avoided that. Because now my data set is always sitting on a single server. The problem with doing that is that, again, let's say that I have 500 servers. Then, okay, how many of you ever had to do a migration in production? How many of you enjoy that? Wow. How many of you think that doing migration in production for 500 machines is going to be fun? Okay. Real story, FriendFeed recently moved from using MySQL, recently, 2 years ago, using MySQL as relational data store to using MySQL as an object, as an object store, key value store, just because they literally could not handle doing migrations every time that they push a new feature out. And now we have things like replication. How do I replicate between two servers? Well, you have the replication that the database provider gives you, and they will just love you to use that because they are going to charge you extra for each and every replication license that you buy. And without those two, you literally cannot get high availability. You can't get the performance that you need to meet your scaling requirement. So that was the situation 5 to 10 years ago. And that is when people started noticing all of those. We no longer had a single server, single database that we need to worry about. Our data set was spread across multiple machines. And those are called the fallacies of distributed computing. I have them hanging on the wall, so every once in a while I can look at them every single time that I that they come in to do a review of an application, someone is violating at least 9 of them, and there are only 8. Okay? Network, this too, especially, latency is 0, backbone is infinite, all the time. This is also called selected plus 1, for the people of you who are familiar with ORMs or general databases. Anyway, so before I get into why we want to move away from SQL, this is Edgar Koch. He wrote the foundation for what became relational databases. We still have it, okay? And what is important to understand is that the NoSQL movement isn't so much about, okay, we are done with tables and SQL and stuff like that. It's more, okay, because SQL can no longer fill the role for every single data storage need that we have, we want to, instead of trying to avoid the problem, let's embrace that. Let's figure out exactly what are the things that we want to do, exactly what are the data access patterns, data access behavior that this part of the application has, and let's find the optimal solution for that. And in some cases, the optimal solution would be a relational database. But the main point in the NoSQL movement is that don't start and stop in the SQL. We are a Oracle shop, we are a SQL shop, then we just use that. Start by actually doing some analysis of the problem and deciding what is the best solution. Okay, got all of that, okay? Except that this is also important. How many queries does it take to show the home page of my blog? Does anyone know? Or leave aside my blog, just a standard blog post. So, just this. Okay? So, just to look at things, we have things like the actual post, we have comments, we have on the side the future post, we have the a whole bunch of stuff that we actually need to worry about. So anyone wants to guess how many queries it actually takes? Give me numbers.
One.
21. Last time I checked, it was around 17. Every time that you hit the blog post, there is something of the order of 17 queries. Some of them are kept, some of them are not. It's getting complex to actually see out what's going on. But that's about what's going on there. And the problem is that the idea of a post is I have a post, I have comments, I have tags, I have categories that it belongs to. This is a unique object. But because of the way that the relational system works, in order to do that, I have to split a single unique object, an aggregate of all the data about the post, into multiple tables. Because I cannot have collections in a relational database except there's a relation in another table. And now we have this thing. This is called CAP. I'm going to skip it because I don't have that much time. But basically it means that you have consistency, availability, and partition tolerance. And of the three, you can only have two. And this is a very visual example of what happens when you try to have all three. Then we just leave that. Okay, here are all the things that the database does really well, okay? How many of you are doing multi-threaded programming? How many of you are doing, keep your hand up, how many of you are using, building web applications?
Using what?
Building web applications. Okay, so the two groups are actually the same. Everyone who is building web application is building multi-threaded application. We usually don't think about that because the part where we actually does the synchronization is in the relational database, where it does things like transactions, like isolating us from concurrent work. The problem with that is that along with all those benefits, it's also these disadvantages, such as that the schema is very hard to work with, such as that if I want to have a dynamic schema, I just want to throw some three fields in this entity and some four field identity. Okay, custom fields, user defined, user generated content, all of these sort of things are very, very hard to do in relational databases. In fact, there aren't any good solution for that. There are all sorts of half-baked things that work in this context or that context, but nothing you can really say, this is how I want to use. I want to use this. And obviously, normalization kills when you have to touch a lot of databases. If I have to do a join across machines, I'm dead. Just from the point of view of the performance of the application. And I can't really use distributed transactions because of CAP. Because even though people like to pretend that distributed transactions, system transaction, DTC, is the solution for consistency, what we're actually saying, if there is a problem in the network, I want to fail completely. And that is actually the best case scenario. How many of you are using DTC? Okay, how many of you have problems with DTC? There are actually more people having problems with DTC than people using it. Okay? So, this is not some theoretical problem. It happens every single day. Okay, so because of those, then we now need to start thinking about, okay, what are the things that a relational database still gives me when I have to work with multiple machines? And it turns out that there are still some things that it does really, really well, such as reporting, such as ad hoc querying, but there are a lot of things that it doesn't do well. And this is where the NoSQL solutions come into play. Blah, 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 we don't care about that. Okay. Remind me to talk about this at the end, but basically, because people have had to start working, had to abandon SQL because they had scale needs, they had to develop a solution, and those solutions aren't appropriate only at the high end. Using something like a document database is very appropriate for just non-scalable application, just because the model that he worked with, the document database, is so much easier to work with for many things than just using a relational database. If you're working with a domain-driven design, then a document database is a natural fit. Let me just outside. Okay, we have ACID. ACID is atomic consistent isolated DOM. Okay, this is what relational database gives us. Unfortunately, we have to put an X on the C because of the CAP theorem. Instead, most of the non-SQL databases use something called BASE. BASE is basically available, soft state, eventually consistent. It's a really, really nice acronym. Doesn't really mean much at this point. We don't care about this. Okay, let's look at those. We have something called key value store. What is a key value store? It's this guy. I have a key, which is a string, and I have the value, and the value is just some byte array. And this is very important because the set of operations that the dictionary has is very limited. Not only is it very limited, it is very easy to split it across multiple systems. Try to imagine that. I have to store 500 million users. I can't store it on a single machine. I have to use 500 machines to do that. What is the complexity of finding the user in a key value store? What is the complexity of the dictionary? Okay, either I went and I'm now giving a lecture to the Bakesell committee, or we have a problem. Okay, oh wow, thank you. I was scared for a moment. iDictionary has a dictionary has a O1 complexity for doing a search. What is the complexity of doing a search in a key value store? It is also O1, okay? And why is that? Because given the key, we can do this. We can just do sharding. Basically, we're doing a modulo and finding that Allende is sitting on this server. And Bjorn is sitting on that server. And now we just have to make a single request to that server to do some operation on that. It's actually slightly more complicated than that, because we have to deal with things that, okay, what happened when I run out of space on the existing servers and I want to add a new server? And this is called resharding. This is a, depending on the product that you use, this is as easy as just put up a new server, to as complicated, okay, we have to take down the entire site for 3 days to do the resharding process. Okay, basically, key value store gives you the three operations: get, set, and delete. Some of them, such as Redis, give you more advanced things and says, okay, this, the value of this key is a list, is a set. I'm going to give you the ability to do add, remove, or contains on this key. Different key value stores give you different guarantees. Maybe they keep all the data in memory. Maybe they flash it to disk. Maybe they do something in between. Those are things that you have to be aware of when you choose the key value product that you want to use. So, for example, a very commonly used key value store is Memcached. And this is purely in memory, very, very fast. And most of the work is done in the client in terms of doing resharding or stuff like that. Amazon Dynamo, which is what Amazon's shopping cart is sitting on, is a much more complete product, which basically allows you, okay, just throw three more servers on the farm, and the system will just reconfigure itself automatically, and data will move around. And if we shoot this server, then other server will take its load, and at no point in time we will lose any data. Those are basically the two ends of the spectrum. From in-memory, you're responsible for doing everything, to Dynamo, data is never going to get lost, and the Dynamo client and Dynamo server will actually handle things for you. Blah, blah, blah. Something very important. In a key value store, I can only query by the key. That seems to be redundant to say that, but this is important. Let's say that I'm going to store orders, or you know, I'm going to store the product catalog in a key value store. Because most of the time, I'm going to access the product by its key. By SKU, I have no idea how you pronounce that. But what happens if I want to find all the products whose color is blue? How can I do that in a relational database? Selects are from products where color equal blue. How do I do that in a key value store? What? Table set. Okay, so one option would be, let me read the entire data set. The problem is that most key value stores doesn't support an operation called give me all the keys, such as Memcached. You literally have no ways of saying give me all the keys. You cannot do a key table swap. Moreover than that, imagine that again we have 50 servers running a key value store. So how do we perform a query such as give me all the blue products? The answer is that we don't. Okay? We literally cannot do that. The system does not support it. What we can do is have a key called products colon blue, and in that key we can put a list of all the products whose name is blue, whose color is blue. This is called a secondary index. So basically, we are going to maintain that ourselves. This is very, very common in NoSQL solutions, because what the NoSQL solution basically gives is expose to you the underlying abstraction that is actually happening. We cannot support searching in a key value store because it may be distributed and we don't have knowledge of the entire data set. But if every time that we update the data, we keep track of the blue products, then I can just access the key for the blue products and get the pre-computed data up front. There is also an additional thing here. If I'm going to run a query like that in a relational database, maybe I have an index, maybe I don't, but anyway, I have to do some amount of work in order to make this happen. If you use a secondary index, that work has already been done at the runtime. And because most applications, the vast majority of applications, have 99% reads versus 1% write, if that, that means that for the most part, I'm willing to sacrifice some additional complexity at the right time in order to get much better performance at the read point, at the read time. Okay, we don't care about concurrency. We do care about where you want to use that. And low latency, because all searches, all queries are going to be O1. And high rate of operations, because it is so easy to scale this thing. Just throw more servers, and assuming that you solve the resharding problem, which some projects have, it just works. Okay? We don't care about this either. Okay? We don't care about this. Okay? Here are a few things that implement this. The key value store. This is mine. Okay? I'm pretty happy about that. Questions so far? I'm going fast, so if you don't understand something, please stop me. Questions? Yes?
What about locks on your secondary indexes? How do you handle that?
What about what?
Locks. When you want to update the key that holds all the three products.
That is, okay, so locking on the secondary index, is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay, so that actually depends on how the key value store is implemented. Some key value stores, such as Redis, allows you to do native operations on some keys, so you can do add to list, add to set. At that point, this is handled entirely inside the key value store, and there is no locking involved at all from your point of view. More questions? Yes. How do you deal with migrations? So remember that we had a very simple schema, a byte array. So migration at that point is entirely your responsibility. One of the common ways of doing that is just to store the data in a version-safe serialization format, which may be protocol buffers, maybe JSON, maybe XML, but basically this is entirely your problem. Yeah. Seriously, something that you will notice repeatedly, the reason that those things are powerful because they give up stuff. We won't handle that, this is your responsibility. And by not telling you that, they gain a lot of freedom to be more scalable, more performant, easier to use in the vast majority of cases. Moving on. Okay, this is a derivative of the key value store. This is what I talk about when I talk about Amazon Dynamo. And basically, it does replication on the fly. But notice what happens here. Here, I'm writing some value, but I have a network failure. So the question is, what's going to happen now when I'm doing the get after the network failure? Who wants to guess? And the answer is that we're going to get 24 and 48 and 42. Both of them together as two distinct values. Because the data store basically says, okay, something bad happened. I don't know how to deal with that. You just get, because remember, those are just two byte arrays. And it has no idea how to deal with them. So when a conflict occurs, when something like that happens, then it just says, okay, here are the 2 or 3 or 10,000 values that currently exist for this key, where there should be only one value. Because remember, those are replicated data source. And it's your responsibility to store the, to do the merge between all of them. Now, this is how, again, this is a base, this is how the Amazon shopping cart work. If I'm hitting the Amazon shopping cart and I'm adding something to my shopping cart and then I'm hitting it again and something happened in the Amazon data center, one thing that Amazon absolutely do not want to happen is for me to lose the shopping cart. Okay, obviously. Now, what happened if, I don't know, At some point, I had this network breach, and now I have two versions of my shopping cart. One of them which includes the book Ruby in Action, and another calls DSL Zimbu. So we have two completely separate copies for the user OEM. What is Amazon going to do? Yes? It's going to do a merge. And just, okay, here there is stuff from here. Here there is stuff from here. Let's just merge them together. Oh, so if I had a book in both items, it's probably doing, okay, let's just use one of them. But the idea here is that you never lose the right. Because if you lose the right, you lose money. Blah, blah, blah. This is same thing. This is just important. This is merge concurrency. Okay. Notice this is more complicated than simple key value store. I would use, for the user session, assuming that I can handle its loss, I will use something like Memcached. Maybe I will use some Memcached Plus application. For shopping cart, for orders, for stuff like that, I would use this. I will use something that I know that I just got $1 million order. I absolutely do not want it to get lost. Blah, 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 blah. Again, this is the project I implement stuff. Amazon Dynamo is obviously proprietary, and it's not exposed through the Amazon Web Services cloud thingy. Project Voldemort and RunDHT are open source projects that you can download and use. Questions? We'll skip that too. We don't need a break. Okay. Yeah, I told you. Remember my goal? Okay. Anyway, document database. Document database are basically, okay, let's start with the key value data store, but instead of the value being just a battery, let's have the value in a format that the database can understand. Usually this is JSON derivative. And this is the whole thing about document database. That's it. It's just a key value store, or the value is JSON. So can you guess why is this so important? That it is an entirely different data store? Yes. What? Persistence? No, because it persists JSON or bytecode in the same manner.
Period.
What?
Period.
I cannot hear you. Don't think so. At least I cannot hear you very well. Okay, so I don't think so. But try to mention something. Okay. No, I have curry. I don't know what curry is except a good Indian food. So I apologize. But so the major point about document database being so powerful because they understand the format of the data is that they can actually perform operations on this data. So let's take a look. Here are a set of documents. Let's pretend that they are in a JSON format. Why is this so? Now, because the format is in JSON, because the database understands JSON, we can now do things like, we don't care, like, blah, 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 blah. Let's do it. We can now define something called an index or a view. This is an index. Does it look familiar to anyone? One, two, maybe? Okay, thank you. Okay, so this is a link query. And this link query is basically going to run on this data, and because the data is known, and this is just going to run on that, we are going to be able to do a lot of interesting things. So, let me just show you a real sample. I need to start the server, and I should have done it before, so we'll skip that. I'm actually going to do a whole talk about document databases. Actually, RevDB, which is a document database, tomorrow on the last session. So you're welcome to join. But basically, I can define indexes. In RevDB case, this is just using inks. And the database operates on the documents, which means that coming back to how do I find all the blue products, just define an index that does the search for it, and it just works. So by understanding the data, you get a lot more. More than that, there is also a very important side effect to thinking about modeling data in documents. Because look at this guy. This would sit on three different tables in a relational database. But this is a single document inside the document database. This is important because it means that most operations inside the document database, most request responses we have to do, only operate on a single document. Maybe they operate on a usually they are either operated on a single document or they make a query and just do the projection from the document itself. So this is much much better performance for things like doing transaction processing. If I'm talking about DDD, then I have the notion of an aggregate. And all changes to the post, even if I want to make a change to the comment, it has to go through the post because the post is the aggregate. Trying to implement that using relational databases has always been tricky. You have to do cost locking and whole bunch of stuff like that. Trying to implement that in a document database, well, you don't have to. This is how it works. Okay, blah, 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 blah. Okay, we don't care about that. Transactions usually happen only on a single document boundary. The schema is JSON, so it's human readable, blah, 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 you don't care. Something that is actually very important, try to imagine the case of an order. So an order has things like shipping address, billing address. Those are embedded inside the document. But what about the customer? How are we going to represent the reference to a customer in a document database? Well, in a relational database, we'd have a call customer ID. In a document database, we tend not to do that. Because document database doesn't have the notion of a join. Why don't they have the notion of a join? Because document database are meant to be sharded at the high scale. And because they are meant to be sharded, that means that you can't really do a job between machine here and machine B. So what we are doing instead is saying, okay, we're going to capture the data inside the document itself. So the customer property inside the order document is going to have things like the customer ID and the customer name. This is basically us doing the normalization. So because of that, we can think of a document as an isolated unit. We should be able to take a look at the document and treat it as a single, isolated, complete data set. We don't have to go and look at other stuff to understand how it works. We can just look at the document itself. This is how this works. If you want to show a post, we have to have only a single call to the document database. Just give me the post number XYZ. Okay. Blah blah blah. There are basically three commonly used document databases. CouchDB, MongoDB, and RevDB. Couch and Raven are very similar in the sense that you store documents in them and they have the idea of, how do I say that? And they have the idea of being able to query things by defining indexes or views. This is the link query that I showed you before, and this is running on the background. and actually creating the data. So when you actually make a query, you're actually putting the compiled index, the pre-computed index. So queries on those things are very, very fast. And querying, so indexing doesn't slow runs. This is another important aspect. Because indexing happens in the background, that means that no matter how many indexes you have, the runs can just just go through, you know, very, very cheap. MongoDB works much closer to the model. I'm thinking about relational database without a schema. A lot of the things that you're familiar with from relational database, such as indexes are expensive on writes, or being able to do dynamic queries, are presented in Mongo. Mongo also tends to be much faster because Mongo writes to memory first and only flush to disk after. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, we don't care. We don't care about this either. Things to use, orders, invoices, anything that is literally a document, I like to put in a document database. I also like to think about things in aggregates and install them there. Okay, so sharding, mirror replication, pretty much. Questions so far? Yes. Okay, so if the indexes aren't being updated at runtime, how do they work from a consistency point of view? Well, in RabbitDB, the way that it works is that you're going to get stale data. So usually the time between index update, between document write and index update is something in the order of a few milliseconds, depending on your hour mostly, but a few milliseconds up to number. But in the meantime, nothing stops. So you can still query the database and still query the index, and you will get results back. And you will get the note to say, okay, the results may be stale. There may be something in this database. The results of this index may not represent the actual data from the database. So that is actually tends to be very, very common. That you don't actually don't care for after the milliseconds accuracy, because you're much more concerned with doing things like how fast can I serve requests overall. So if I just made a change and I want to see it, I can just see it. But if I want to make a query, maybe it will take half a second for it to show up everywhere. You can also say, okay, I want to really get up to the milliseconds. Accuracy, at which point what you're saying is basically, okay, I'm going to lock until the database finishes doing whatever it's doing. But consider how often you use something like a cache, which is basically doing just that. So in most cases, you really don't care. And you gain the benefit of not having to wait for writes and not having to wait for it. More questions? Yes.
How do you, when you copy the data and get the data in the document, how do you ensure like something like the tag values, for instance, that they only that's only specific set of values, so they don't want to allow any kind of value in? Do you need a business layer or something in the middle?
Yeah, to validate? Basically, the document database does not impose schema. If you want to take customer database, a customer document, and just put all the data inside, you could do that. The database will not stop you from doing that. Where it usually handles is in your application logic. You usually don't work with the documents directly. You work with some sort of object model, and you serialize that object model to the document form. This is what actually gives you that. One last question? Great, let's move on. Graph databases. Graph databases are funny because they answer some very specific questions. Okay? So we have a graph of people. And I want to know who is in town today that I know that likes to see action movies. A graph database can answer that question very, very fast. Not only about the people I'm directly connected to, but people who are connected to people I'm connected to. That is the entire purpose of a graph database. This is turned out to be an extremely useful thing to have when you're talking about social networks. So think about something like Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. This is how we implement these sort of questions based on graph databases. Blah, blah, blah. So here's an example of doing a graph walk. Starting from some node, I want to find all the people that I know in the last year. So this is the way of performing the query. Now, here's a problem. How many of you are familiar with 6 degrees of separation? Okay. So, from one guy through 6 steps, you can get to any other guy in the world. So, why is this important? Because it also means that you cannot shard graph database. Because there is no way of finding a meaningful subgraph in a real-world graph, so you can put it all on the same machine. So here's an example. What happens if we literally just split it up? That means that most of the queries are going to cross through network boundaries. And the way that graph database works, they are extremely chatty when they traverse between the nodes. So putting graph database, or trying to shard the graph database, tends to have a huge impact on performance. So the way that most people use graph database is store only the graph data. This is not a general purpose data store. This is literally just to answer these set of queries. So because you only store specific data, the size of the database grows, becomes much smaller, and you can store it on a single server. And if you want performance, you usually use a master slave. Okay. There is Neo4j. This is pretty much the standard as far as I can say. There is FlockDB, which can answer, which is what Twitter uses? Yes. But it only answers one level of separation. So who are the guys that you know? It can answer that question very, very fast. It cannot answer who are the guys that knows people you know. I'm sorry. It's starting to get confusing at some point. We don't have time for questions because I have 4 more minutes to cover the most complex part. Okay, so this is something called column databases, which is also known as big table. Blah, 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 blah. This is how I store data in a big table. I have the key, and I have columns. Now, contrary to all expectations, data in a column family database is stored based on the column name. Not on the column data, on the column name. Totally and utterly strange when you first think about that. But it actually makes sense when you start thinking about the big table database is meant from the get-go to run on hundreds of machines. So sorting inside a big table database is done first by the row key, this guy, and then by the column name. This is very important because that means that I can very efficiently find the appropriate data inside the column family database. And now you can see this guy, here the key. So those two are tweets. And you can see something very interesting. There is no schema. These two are tweets and they have 2 completely different data sets inside. Now we want to be able to answer the questions. Give me all the tweets by end. Give me the last 25 tweets by end. So I can answer that and say, okay, let's go to the timeline column family for end. And now give me the first 25 records. This is not records. This is actually, this is a column name, this is a column value. They are sorted by the column name. So because this is incremental, I can actually say, okay, give me the last 25 from here, and it gives me 25 records which contain the tweet ID, which I can then go and just gather from here. This is completely non-intuitive if you're familiar with relational database. But you have to understand that column family databases are literally what happens when you start thinking about how can I make a database that are truly incredibly scalable. And it turns out that in such databases, you cannot make queries. Queries are literally not possible. What you can do is ask for, give me this row by key, or give me all rows starting from this key. So a key and a key range. That's all. And I'm sorry this is complex enough as is, but you just have to understand that those are the only things that you do. There are no joins in the database. If you want to do that, you have to do it manually. And secondary indexes are very, very common in those sorts of things. The major benefit is that you literally have the ability to run any sort of data set in those sorts of databases. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, so Google BigTable is obviously the most popular one. HBase and Cassandra are open source projects that you can use to see how it works. Any questions? Not just questions so far, but yeah, questions. But column family? Great. So I think that there is something happening tomorrow about column families. I'm not sure. But if not, there are a couple of very good articles about Cassandra that explain the entire concept, and there is the Google article, the Google paper about BigTable. It's a bit academic, but it's still very interesting. So, with NoSQL, we don't have transactions over more than a single item, be it a key in a key value store, a document, a single value in a BigTable. We don't have transactions because at scale, transactions are impossible to support. Reporting in most situations from a NoSQL is either very, very simple because the data is already in a format that fits the report, or impossible. If the data does not fit if the data that you have in the data store cannot, it does not match the way that the report wanted, you cannot write a report. You can do what is essentially a table scan in order to find all the data and then do the massaging of the data manually, but obviously this is not the way to go. Powerful reporting features can be made to happen, but they require a lot of work in order to have the data model on the data store to support it. In a SQL databases we're used to, here's the data. The only complexity is how complex do I want to make the query to project the data into the report. In NoSQL database, you literally have no possibility of doing that. And finally, referential integrity, as I said, does not exist simply because if I have 500 machines, it is too expensive to try to find if the phone key is valid or not. I accept the possibility that it may not be valid, and I move on. And final questions. And I'm going to play a trick on you. This always works. Final questions, going once, twice, three times. And this is the trick. The moment that I say enough, someone will ask a question. Always works. Okay, thank you very much.